Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Hi there, Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and also director of the Princeton Election Consortium.
Well, we're right in the middle of an election season, and when you're swept up with election mania, many Americans like to think or imagine that it will be easy to remake the playing field when new people are in power. Every election season, we hear from candidates who promise that when they're president, things will be fundamentally different. We hear this in congressional campaigns as well. They'll be able to reset the table. They'll be able to start things fresh. And we hear this outside the world of politics as well, everywhere from business to academia, with people imagining that a new way is possible. But it doesn't work that way. Policies, institutions, ideas, norms all become entrenched over time and are often very difficult to dismantle. They can outlast the people that created them, and they can have effects that go on for decades, if not centuries, after they were created. And today, to talk about this, we have with us Paul Starr, who's a professor of sociology and public affairs here at Princeton University. He's also the co-founder and founding co-editor of The American Prospect, an important magazine for American liberalism. Paul Starr was also the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction and the Bancroft Prize in American History. He's published several books, including The Social Transformation of American Medicine, The Creation of the Media, Freedom's Power, and Remedy and Reaction. Today, we're going to discuss his new book, Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies, which is just out with Yale University Press. So you've written about healthcare and the media. Why'd you decide to write a book about entrenchment?
So this is a much broader and I think more ambitious book. It's really about the foundations of politics and society. It's about the hardest to reverse foundational aspects of society. So when I talk about entrenching something, I mean cementing it. I mean cementing it at the foundations of society. Sometimes that's deliberate. For example, lawyers talk about constitutional entrenchment. That's writing a rule into a constitution so as to make it hard to change. Our constitution in particular is very difficult to amend. But entrenched aspects of society and politics can also emerge without anybody's intent. And so this book is about both what I call strategic entrenchment, the deliberate entrenchment, often of power and privilege, and also these indirect processes that produce things that perhaps even sometimes people on both sides find hard to change.
And the difference between strategic entrenchment, which is, of course, more intentional, and the second, the indirect kinds of entrenchment. What is the second kind? Give us an example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, so there are, for example, many aspects of technology that emerge and become hard to change. The classic example is the QWERTY keyboard, you know, the standard typewriter keyboard that is passed over to computers. Certainly when that was introduced, it was introduced actually first with the telegraph and then with typewriters in the 19th century, supposedly because it would prevent the jamming of keys. It would actually slow people up. It's not clear that really was the reason, but whatever the reason was, the people who introduced it didn't think, oh yes, this people will be stuck with this keyboard a century later. It happened, again, for particular reasons at the moment, and yet like many other systems, like many other technologies, like many other institutional patterns, sometimes adopted only for expedient reasons of the moment, they become hard to change. What becomes hard to change is that it's the costs of change. It's the switching costs. Now, sometimes the switching costs can be overcome, but very often the switching costs just become enough of a barrier so that things get stuck in a pattern.
And in terms of strategic entrenchment, so with entrenchment, we are talking about policies or institutions that are created, and they outlast often the people who created them. They can go for decades, if not centuries. Strategic entrenchment, do policymakers think about things like this? Are they cognizant of trying to make things that will last for long periods of time beyond doing so in an abstract way?
Sure. I think very clearly they do. And I'm again, a constitution is a very good example of that. But it doesn't only apply to constitutions. And let me just emphasize, I use the word entrenchment in a neutral way. It can be good. It can be bad. It really depends altogether on what is entrenched. Sometimes it is power that is entrenched. Sometimes it is rules that are entrenched. Some of those rules may protect equality and freedom. Many of us care deeply about maintaining the entrenched rules in our Constitution that protect free speech, that protect equal rights. These are crucial foundations. And, you know, I could give many examples. Let's just think about the time in the 1930s when Social Security was passed. And some people objected to the fact that the tax, the payroll tax for Social Security, wasn't itself a progressive tax. It paid by all wage earners and not higher for high-income people. And when an aide made that criticism to Franklin Roosevelt, he said, with that tax in there, no damn politician is ever going to be able to scrap my Social Security program. And what he meant by that is when people feel they've paid into this program, when they feel they've earned their benefits, it would be very hard to take those benefits away. And I think that turned out to be right.
So that's an example of Franklin Roosevelt purposely building in an entrenchment that would lead to something super hard to reverse. I think about cognitive scientists when cognitive scientists talk about things like loss aversion, where you have a thing like if I say how much you're going to give me for this coffee mug, and you won't give me more than like say whatever $4 for the coffee mug, but once I give you the coffee mug, oh, it's a great coffee mug and you don't want to give it up anymore. And so even if I were to tell you, say, well, instead of Social Security, there's this other approach to assuring for your retirement that would work at least as well, immediately loss aversion kicks in.
Yes. So let's just take the case of Social Security, because it has proved to be a very strongly entrenched program. And there's another aspect to Social Security, and that is after amendments were made to the program, it switched to a pay-as-you-go basis. So it accumulated obligations faster than it accumulated reserves. And that created in the early 2000s, when George W. Bush wanted to privatize Social Security, he ran into what was called the double payment problem. Because if workers were going to divert their Social Security payments into private accounts, there would be the small problem of paying for all the accumulated benefits of people on Social Security or who are going to go on Social Security soon. And that double payment problem was an example of what I talked about before, the switching costs. So there was the element of entrenchment produced by the intentional aim of Roosevelt. And then there was this unintentional aspect, which really proved to be the decisive obstacle to the privatization of Social Security.
So the act of entrenching is a high-stakes game in which politicians or policymakers are trying very hard to build into our society some default option. I'm again using the language of cognitive science, where the easy thing to do, the thing that everyone ought to do, might be having Social Security. Or I'm going to pivot in a second to things like single member legislative districts or what have you. And at some point, choices get made. So I wanted to. This is interesting because now we're in a situation, as you say, entrenchment can work in either direction. And so at some level, looking at changes in government right now, this upheaval of the last 20 years, in some sense, it's a conservative revolution that at least is the first things that I think of going back to the mid-1990s, a program to de-entrench some things that were considered to be sacred. Social Security might be one. Another one might be one person, one vote, where you count all the people in a district for purposes of making sure that the district is a certain size or whatever it might be. I mean, you know, if it's a court precedent, then that would be in some sense entrenchment. We've always had Supreme Court review. Well, we've always had nine members of the Supreme Court. Now, in your book, you write about the history of to focus in a little bit, of single-member districts and how it was that the U.S. ended up with that and how other countries ended up with things like proportional representation. Do-gooders will say, well, you know, we should have proportional representation. So how do we end up getting it back into this corner where we have to have single-member districts?
Okay, so this is a really interesting history about how different democracies ended up choosing different electoral rules that have enormous consequences. So we have a system that it's essentially taken from the British model of single-member districts, first-past-the-post elections. So you can win with a plurality. You don't have to have a majority. And other countries moved toward various types of proportional representation. Instead of single-member districts, you have large multi-member districts with parties getting seats in line with their share of votes. And these two different models of democracy have very different consequences. One of the standard observations is that our kind of system produces two major parties because people feel generally that a vote for a third party is probably going to be wasted. So you get these two dominant parties. So actually parties become entrenched, much more entrenched in our kind of electoral system than in a system with proportional representation, where third parties and fourth parties can more easily get a share of seats. People aren't wasting their votes when they vote for them. And therefore the parties change more. There's less rigidity in the party system. And the thing is, once a country goes down one road rather than another, there are these very powerful forces perpetuating that choice. So just, you know, in a two-party system, actually neither of the two parties generally wants to shift to proportional representation because they don't want to see third and fourth parties emerge. Even if one party dominates and the other is secondary to it, there are usually members in the lesser party that have safe districts and they don't want to give them up. They are afraid of a shift to proportional representation. And the same thing happens in proportional representation. Now, there are changes historically. There just aren't a lot of them. This is what I mean by entrenchment. It creates a barrier to change. It doesn't make it impossible. So in the 1990s, New Zealand actually did shift from our kind of electoral system to proportional representation. There was a crisis of legitimacy in New Zealand. There was a popular referendum, and they changed to proportional representation. Now, why is this so important? I think one particular reason has to do with the position of urban-based parties. And in our kind of system, in a single-member district system, it just so happens that parties that have high concentrations of voters in cities tend to get underrepresented. These generally are parties of the left. In effect, they waste a lot of votes in urban districts where they have huge majorities. And very often in such situations, the other party, the more conservative party, with greater strength in the suburbs and rural areas, they're often able to win a majority of seats, even though they don't get a majority of votes. And that has happened in all these former English colonies, as well as Britain itself and the United States, that the conservative parties have benefited from this system of single-member districts. So it becomes—
Because they are able to hold together and be a plurality or some kind of coalition.
Because their supporters are more efficiently distributed. The party of the left typically has excessively densely clustered votes in cities, and they generally lose out. The data on this is not in my book. This is in Jonathan Rodden's new book, Why Cities Lose, explains it at great length with considerable quantitative evidence why this is the pattern in all of these countries with these British-style elections. And by the way, many of those countries with British-style elections have nonpartisan districting, so that's not the whole explanation for the pattern.
But it's also true that conservative parties are more cohesive, that it's possible to build, like, say, a 40% coalition of, you know, whatever the dominant ethnic group is in a country, whether it be the U.S. or the U.K. or what have you. There's something more homogenous that they're rewards a plurality party. So I feel like there's other things going on in there. Now, what about polarization? It seems like then that comes next, and you've written about that as well. What are your thoughts about whether these factors, say in the United States, lead toward polarization, issue separation of the parties, that kind of thing?
Well, that's a relatively recent development in the United States. So, you know, we went through a period in the mid-20th century when the two parties overlapped a great deal ideologically. There were liberal Republicans, there were conservative Democrats, there were a great many in the center. Many people look back nostalgically to that period when there was a lot of conviviality and bargaining between the two parties. They were able to maintain bipartisanship on many issues, foreign policy and so forth. And now that has disappeared. So why has that disappeared? I think there are a lot of reasons for that change. And one part of it has to do with the growing urban-rural divide in the United States, where, again, the Democratic Party has become a predominantly urban party. The Republican Party is a party of rural areas and exurbs, and the two fight over the suburbs. It just so happens that many kinds of issues, cultural issues like abortion and sexuality and so forth, views about those issues, opinions about those issues, are very strongly correlated with population density. So you get these you know, culture wars on top of the partisan disagreements, and I think that has all contributed to polarization. And it doesn't help also that in the same period we've seen changes in the media. This is kind of a different subject, but you know, in the mid-20th century, for example, when there were just three dominant television networks, most Americans watched the same news on TV. There were very strong incentives toward in those networks to stay close to the center. We had the wire services, Associated Press, and so forth. All these things cultivating neutrality and staying to the center. And since then, with the development first of cable, changes in radio first with Rush Limbaugh, then changes in cable television, now with the internet. We've seen this self-segregation of right and left, and increasingly people are living in different factual universes. And I think all of that has intensified the changes taking place in the country politically.
And how do you think, so you write in the fourth chapter, I believe, on the tensions between democracy and entrenchment. And it seems as government grows, as the federal government has become more pronounced, it does more things, the policies are bigger, that tension would become even more severe in that programs are consuming more of the budget and there's less room to do new things after elections. Is this the case, or is there a way to see democracy working fine, even as these forces of entrenchment harden?
Well, I don't think I'd want to say that there's less room for government to do new things. I personally think there are a great many things that government could still do, and you know, we didn't have to pass a multi-trillion-dollar tax cut in 2017. You know, if Democrats reversed that tax legislation, if they were willing to tax the super rich in the way, for example, that Elizabeth Warren has suggested, I think the federal government could do a lot of things. That's not for me the major reason why there is a threat of entrenchment. I do think there is a risk of conservative power becoming entrenched. And I think that is most likely to happen through the Supreme Court. You know, now we have a 5-4 conservative majority. If Donald Trump is reelected in 2020, most likely he would have the opportunity to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, perhaps also Stephen Breyer. We might go from a 5-4 court to a 7-2 court. I think that would be a much more radically conservative court. I think it would make it very difficult for Democrats in the future administration to take a variety of new initiatives. I think, for example, the whole problem of climate change. If we don't do anything before the late 2020s, after a second Trump term, it will be more difficult, more costly to do that. And if you have a Supreme Court that is opposed to regulation, that is willing to strike down new environmental regulation on any number of grounds, then I think, you know, we're going to be in deep, deep trouble. So we may see entrenchment of conservative power. I don't think that's for fiscal reasons, for budgetary reasons. I think it's much more likely to be because of the court.
And there's some who would argue, just picking up on that, that and they don't always use the term entrenchment, but that conservatives have been more deliberative and effective at this since the 1980s, whether you're talking about the court strategy to gradually fill the federal courts with conservative justices, thinking about partisan gerrymandering in 2010, that they're more attuned to the processes you're talking about in the book than Democrats have been. So I'm curious, A, do you agree with that? Is there an imbalance between the parties in doing this? And B, if that's true, what explains Democrats being less attuned to these sorts of phenomena?
Well, first of all, I think Democrats have been greatly limited in this regard. American institutions have not worked in their favor. So just looking over the past two decades, Democrats have lost the presidency twice in the Electoral College.
Despite winning the popular vote.
Despite winning the popular vote.
Gore and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. They have actually won the popular vote for the Senate 11 out of 15 times since 1990, but the Republicans have had a majority in the Senate all but six of those times. And why is that? That's because the Senate overrepresents the more rural, less populous, whiter states. And so
well, that itself, as you write, is itself an act in some sense of gerrymandering, where the Republican Party of the Gilded Age admitted states of smaller population.
Right. Right. And but we're living with the legacy of that pattern. And in fact, I've urged that if Democrats do have a majority in Congress, do regain the White House, one of their top priorities should be to follow that example of Republicans in the 19th century and to do something which I think is justified on the merits, and that is admit two jurisdictions which have large populations of American citizens and who are not represented, who do not have rights of political representation, and those are the people of Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia. And I think that ought to be a high priority in order to rectify this imbalance in the Senate, by the way, an imbalance which operates to the disadvantage of African Americans and Latinos, both of whom are underrepresented in the Senate because of the Senate's overrepresentation of the less populous white states. So there is, I think, a very good case for trying to attack that particular source of entrenched advantage for conservatives. And by the way, you don't need a supermajority to do that if the Democrats eliminate the filibuster. I mean, you can do that with 51 votes in the Senate.
And so now what I want to get to is a piece that you wrote. This is closely related to your book, a recent piece you wrote in The American Prospect, The Anti-Entrenchment Agenda. And I highly recommend this to anyone who's interested in this topic, where, Paul, you get into topics of how to de-entrench. And so let's just linger on this a little bit longer. Paul Starr, what do you think are ways that we can de-entrench these threats to majority rule?
Okay. So in that article, yeah, I talked about three distinct sources of entrenched conservative power. The first is the power of concentrated wealth that, on the whole, supports conservative interests. Second, I talked about the abuses of incumbency to entrench Republicans, for example, through voter suppression. And third, I talked about the way in which American institutions, governmental institutions, now work at a time when there's this very sharp urban-rural divide that works to the disadvantage of Democrats, as it does in the Senate and as it does in the House. And so these are three entirely different things. And in the first case, so let's just talk about the entrenched power of wealth, which has grown because of the increase in income and wealth inequality in the United States. And there are a whole series of things that I think ought to be high on the liberal agenda for trying to rectify the imbalance that's developed in the private market. And that, for example, involves strengthening unions. Republicans have put a lot more effort into weakening unions than Democrats have put into strengthening unions. And on taxes, you can use taxes not only to raise money, but also to create greater equality in political power. And I think that's one of the functions of a wealth tax. So there are a whole series of things that could be done, but you can't do anything about these without getting more political power. And that takes us to the second one. I talked about the abuses of incumbency, and for example, through voter suppression. And really the only way to respond to that is through voter mobilization. And that requires a focused effort to get Democratic constituencies to vote. It requires field operations, organization on the ground. I mean, we're talking here about long-standing patterns where young people, minorities, have not voted at nearly the rate of older people and of whites. So this is crucial, I think, to rectify that problem. And then finally, this question of how governmental institutions operate and why Democrats are facing disadvantages in the structure of the Senate and the structure of the House. The problem in the Senate, I mentioned the idea of admitting new states. In the case of the House, that's much more difficult. It goes back to an idea, Sam, that you mentioned, this idea of proportional representation. Very, very difficult. But it's, you know, I think it's an issue worth raising. Perhaps there might be progress in one state, in a state legislature, to get Americans to think about different ways of choosing their representatives.
So you're now talking about how you can unentrench things a little bit, but let's flip it around. You want to argue that entrenchment is not simply a phenomenon that happens by chance, but you can think about it systematically. So if there was a shift in political power, how would Democrats think about entrenching new policies, assuming they can get legislation through, in the same way that FDR thought about the Social Security tax back in the mid-1930s? Are there certain elements of your book that offer patterns or strategies for how this happens successfully?
Well, that's a really tough question. And, you know, I've thought about that, for example, in relation to climate change and in relation to ideas like a Green New Deal. Because when Democrats think about dealing with the need to decarbonize the economy, they have to think not only about the incredibly difficult step of enacting some legislation for the first time, but of actually sustaining it over time. How are they going to enact it in a form that's going to last? And I think that means trying to create sustaining political coalitions that will help maintain those programs over the long term. And so right now, of course, one of the biggest obstacles to a shift in energy policies is to the fact that we have a huge oil and gas industry that's opposed to these changes. But we also do have an emerging renewables industry. We have people who are working in wind and solar. And as this change develops, there may be the ability to use that new foundation as a way of creating a sustaining political coalition over the long term. And Democrats, I think, have to be savvy about these political realities. So there's the question of, you know, what's the optimal policy? And economists will talk about carbon taxes and so forth. First of all, carbon taxes have not worked politically anywhere. They've been a political non-starter. And they're also, it's not clear to me that they would be sustained, or in fact, the idea of carbon taxes is that they would grow over time, they'd continue to be raised. I just don't see how that works out politically. But there may be other means of supporting new industries, for example, these, you know, solar and wind and so forth, and beginning to generate support from them to counterbalance the oil and gas industry.
And that could easily happen in rural states or what have you, because those are places where they have things like wind and sun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's a different, you know, if you begin thinking about things this way, I think you think about the problems a bit differently.
And before we run out of time, you are one of the leading experts of healthcare. So to connect your two areas of expertise, from what you're seeing with the Affordable Care Act right now in 2019, and I'm not asking you to predict, but is this a policy that looks like it will last, that it will be an entrenched policy, or do you see it as more vulnerable than something like Social Security?
I think it's extremely vulnerable. I think it's vulnerable not only to repeal from Republicans, or perhaps being struck down in court, which is something that could happen, you know, even this year. I think it's also vulnerable because Democrats are not strongly in support of it. Look at all the interest in Medicare for All. So the Affordable Care Act, to me, has not seemed strongly entrenched. Back in 2015, I wrote an article for a book that, Julian, you were one of the co-editors of, in which I made exactly that argument, that I thought although many people drew analogies between the Affordable Care Act and Social Security, or the Affordable Care Act and Medicare, I said the Affordable Care Act really has a much weaker political foundation than either of the other two. And it wasn't clear to me that it would survive. Now, it did survive the attack when Trump was elected, but really only because John McCain, in one of his last votes, put his thumb down. You can't build much of a theory about, you know, around that. And I am not convinced that it has this degree of durability that these earlier programs had.
Well, we're out of time, but Paul Starr, thanks again for joining the show. The book is really fantastic. It's important. It brings together an important area of academic scholarship with current relevant issues. It's called Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies, published by Yale University Press, and it is available everywhere. Thanks again for joining the show.
Thank you, Julian. Thank you, Sam.
Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Listeners, if you have questions for us, you can send them to politicspolls@princeton.edu, or you can just tweet them at us. I'm at Julian Zelizer. Sam?
I'm at Sam Wang, PhD.
And we look forward to talking again soon. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.